to destroy a British sovereignty and bring England into the European Union, just exactly as our leaders are determined to bring us into uniting with Mexico and with Canada, bring us into a North American Union as a stepping stone towards establishment of the one world government with the one world ruler. Well, Colonel, thank you so very much for being with us again.
How do you do? Good afternoon to you.
Well, tell us, why don't you sort of introduce your listeners to who do not know you, who do not remember when you've been with us before, but give us a little of the background of your military service and then, of course, what you're doing at the present time to try to save Great Britain.
Well, to begin with, my army service has little or nothing to do with what I've been working on in the last 20 years. My service was largely the management of engineering services, the organization of management and, running workshops and that sort of thing. It was only about 20 years ago when I had a chance meeting with a retired scientist who'd spent a lot of her life, most of her life, studying what was going on in the world and behind the scenes, that I began to realize there were other things going on than, one had been told by the media and by governments and so on over the years. I'd felt uneasy about a lot of things going on behind the scenes, but, carrying on with my military service. And it was only when it crystallized 20 years ago that I became seriously involved. And since then, it's been a very long learning curve.
Well, I started about 43 years ago. But I'll tell you why, it was exactly the same thing. Something wasn't right, and I just couldn't put my finger on it. As you begin to realize what's going on and get the additional part, it's really overwhelming. And then it took me 20 years, really, to begin to even really begin to grasp how this whole thing began fitting together. So, anyway, tell us what you've learned as far as what's happening in Great Britain, and how far are they along to destroying the sovereignty of your nation?
Well, I think it's a long, slow process, and it has many roots, and they go deep. I think one can pick it up at any stage, and one's not really talking about immediately the European Union. Professor Arnold Toynbee, who had an appointment with the Royal Institute of International Affairs, the equivalent of your Council on Foreign Relations, founded in the early 1920s, I think, he spoke at a conference in Denmark, during which, this was in 1931, by the way, during which he talked about the elimination of national sovereignty by stealth. I mean, it was expressed in much more detail, greater length than I'm relaying it. But this is the essence of what he said. In other words, nationhood was going to become a thing of the past, and this is what they were working towards. Now, he was talking, of course, about the Royal Institute of International Affairs, I mean, of which he was part. Therefore, there had to be some very high-level momentum behind it.
And, of course, he was part of this original group that had been put together by Cecil Rhodes and Lord Milner. We'll be back in just a moment here to continue this discussion here with Colonel Barry Turner. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest today is Colonel Barry Turner, who comes from Great Britain. He is in Great Britain at the present time and concerned about what's happening to his nation. Now, you must understand, if you're out there in the listening audience, that there is a camaraderie between the people of Great Britain and the people, at least many people here in the United States. We had a common heritage, we had a common idea. Many of the ideas that went into our Revolutionary War were those ideas that came from Great Britain, these ideas of limited government and a bicameral legislature, and really, of course, England's laws were built upon God's word, as were our laws initially. So what happens to Great Britain today should really concern us, and of course, Colonel Turner was talking about how back in the 1930s, why Arnold Toynbee, who was the most eminent historian of that era, was talking about the move towards world government, but they couldn't tell the public that. Well, anymore, they can tell the American people today that the reason we're not closing our borders is because our leaders don't believe in national sovereignty. They really want to join together with Mexico, but You can't tell the American people that. You can't tell them why we're really fighting over in Iraq, because they would rise up in the righteous indignation. So they've deceived the people of Great Britain about the real purpose of the European Union. They've concealed the truth in the American people about the true meaning of CAFTA and NAFTA as stepping stones to a government of the Western Hemisphere. Colonel, please pick up the story there.
Again, one has to go back in time to the Design for Freedom Committee, which was a committee of 24, chaired by a well-known Conservative Member of Parliament. Now, this Design for Freedom Committee in 1947 produced a document, it's a short pamphlet, called Design for Europe. Now, in this, it made it quite clear, again, that the people would have to be led by stealth to substantial economic changes. Our trade was very heavily based on the empire, as it was, or the Commonwealth, as it became. It was very clear that this was going to be prized open as power was consolidated. I mean, these were the implications. The Iron and Steel Community, I think it was called, 1951, the agreement, which involved largely France and Germany as the major powers, that was the beginning, that was the foundation of what was taking place in Europe. And through the Treaty of Rome, and I think it was 1953 or 57, I'm not quite sure which, offhand. But you see, gradually, this original treaty, which began nominally in the case of iron and steel, was expanded
Hold that thought, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan. The Colonel Turner was simply talking about how the original treaty came with the Treaty of Rome and these other treaties, really in the early 1950s, were really aimed at a stepping stone towards the consolidation of a new government, the government of Europe, with the destruction of British sovereignty. So pick up the story there, please.
You go forward, perhaps, to about 1971-72. Now, I'm quoting from memory, but two command papers were published. This was during the prime ministership of the late Edward Heath. And they laid down the principles for our entry into Europe, because we've been waxing and waning with President de Gaulle and the previous prime minister, Harold Macmillan. Sitting on the fence, if you like, the treaties... The agreements which were coming under Edward Heath made it stated, in effect, that we would not lose, for example, our judicial system. In other parts, it made it quite clear that, you know, there was going to be a political union. And what happened, we were deluded, quite deliberately deluded, there's no doubt about that if one reads the text of these documents, into thinking that, you know, we could go into Europe without losing our, as it were, heritage, our independence. Because in those days, of course, the currency of the discussion was very much based on economic union, not political union. They kept quiet about that and its implications. Although a House of Lords committee did make it perfectly plain that this was what was going to happen. And of course it came to pass. And I think partly by default, you see, we have finished up in the hands of what one might call a mad anonymous bureaucracy, and our own legislation in this country, what they call gold plates, anything, any diktats coming from the European bureaucracy, so that, you know, the screws are turned even harder when it's disseminated in this country, or put, you know, enacted in this country. And of course, we're in this pickle now, where almost we can neither go forward or back. And of course, we have what in effect is an international socialist government under Blair, nominally the old Labour Party, but international socialism going back to the second and a half international of the early 20th century, where communism and socialism parted the ways, but following different paths to the same objective.
And I think that's really what's so important, is for people to understand that the communists and the international socialists want exactly the same thing. It's only a matter of how they're going to get there.
Yes, I think, you see, we slowly have been losing our our heritage, our culture as we knew it.
But, you know, I think one of the most interesting things is that the what people really don't understand is that some people of great wealth, and even within the banking community, are working with the socialists. And certainly H.G. Wells, in his classic book, An Experiment in Autobiography, told about, you know, at the first part of the last century, a group called the Coefficients was meeting regularly, the leaders of the Fabian Socialists and the leaders of the banking community, Lord Cecil and Lord Milner and Sir Edward Grey, and they were meeting to plan out how they're going to bring about this world government under the control of a ruling elite, and that became the basis of Wells' books, The Open Conspiracy and The New World Order, that he wrote back in the 30s. The average individual, even in Great Britain, doesn't understand. People of great wealth have been pushing these socialist concepts. This is what's so totally contradictory. It doesn't really make sense in many ways, but it's fortunately H.G. Wells was a prolific writer, and sometimes he even told us the truth.
Yes. I'm sure that's right. I haven't read Wells, but I mean, he's a well-known name in this field. I'll give you another instance, just as a point in passing. It was about 1985 when a map of Europe, United Europe, was published by the European Commission. It was apparently freely available on the continent, but very difficult to get hold of in this country. And two campaigners did actually manage to get one. It would be about 1986, 87 when they got hold of the map. Now, this showed Europe, including the United Kingdom, divided into regions. Now, the regions bore no resemblance to the existing county boundaries. Neither were the regional capitals, for the most part, towns or cities that had any authority as regional capitals. The interesting thing here was that on this map, the name England was specifically deleted. Now, I don't believe that could ever have been an error. But when you find your own, you know, a major part of the United Kingdom, your own country, England, simply not shown on the map, then something stinks.
Well, you know, I think it's so absurd that the average Englishman would find it difficult to believe that your leaders could actually be intent upon destroying your own country, and yet they are.
Well, it's difficult to know exactly what the momentum is. Of course, we go back really to cultural communism and the application, as I'm sure you know only too well, of the ideological struggle for the mind. Now, this is where the School for Social Research in Frankfurt am Main began to undertake the task. Marx, at least his successors, knew jolly well that an armed struggle would not take root in the United Kingdom. They tried in Germany, and of course they've been successful in Russia. But it wasn't going to take root in this country, so the alternative, the interrelated alternative, the ideological struggle began. And I think it's much like a virus, as they say. I think it was Gramsci, the Italian communist, was connected with the term the long march through the institutions. In other words, through education, typically. And all our institutions, I think, are now populated by a large number of people who have this virus. Possibly they don't even realize that, you know, what it is themselves, but they are motivated. And this is the direction in which they're moving. And of course, the School for Social Research deliberately set about destroying the culture, the heritage, the family, religion, tradition. And when you open the floodgates and internationalize your concepts, this is where you have international socialism. And the activities of the Blair government in particular are really bringing this to a large extent to fruition. It began before that, but you see, unlimited immigration simply diffuses the original culture. Now, there is this philosophy that all borders should be open and that any form of nationalism is wrong. Now, it comes from this same virus, in my opinion, and you can read it, you know, almost like a book. And now, of course, political correctness has made it almost impossible to raise this question. It's not a race question. It's not a color question. It's a question of the dilution of the fundamental culture.
And of course, you know, the analogy between what's happening in America, there's an organized effort to destroy the culture of America. And you pick up the telephone today and the voice says, now do you want the message in English or in Spanish, you know? What do you mean Spanish, you know? And of course, so many of the forms now are filled out in English or in Spanish. It is an organized effort to destroy the culture of this country so that you can actually pit one group against the other. They know exactly what they're doing, and I'm sure you have the same problem there in Great Britain, although you don't have any other predominant language, do you, at least yet?
Well, I think to a large extent, you see the dumbing down of populations. You know, the bread and circuses approach. People are more excited by soccer football leagues and the celebrities of the media and entertainment, television soap, than they are by issues of serious national importance. A lot of people are very concerned about public services like health and law and order, but their primary interest as a mass of the majority is, as I say, entertainment and all the other diversions from reality. And, you know, life can almost become more real in that sphere than the world and what's going on, you know, about them. I mean, a number of people, of course, are well aware of it. Taxi drivers in London are well known as a source of wisdom and perception. Because, of course, they talk to so many different passengers. But, you see, they know. But where is the power? You see, true democratic power is leached away. It's leached away into the political circles. And, as you have over there, two major political parties, ultimately, with not that much difference between them. And once the vote has been cast, as with the, well, we have three parties if you include the liberal element. But you see, once the vote has been cast, then you have no further say for another session of government until the next election. And you are lied to, you're cheated, and politicians, of course, really are running a closed shop as far as one can see. And until the people take back the initiative from, in our case, members of parliament, and demand that they represent the interests of the people, they will get nowhere. Well, a very good example is the question of money, which of course is the lifeblood, the circulatory system of the entire global body, national and global body, as I think we discussed before. And we're really serving money power, and it's become so great. It transcends national borders in a big way at the touch of a computer button. The creation of money appears to be almost off the scale. It's private money. And of course, we are living with the consequences.
And of course, what we're seeing is progressive erosion of the value of the holdings, the bank deposits, the CDs, the pensions, the annuities, and of course, what's happening in the United States is the planned program to impoverish our people, and the average individual has no idea. He believes what the government tells him. We got 2 or 3% inflation. Well, are you going to believe your lying eyes, or are you going to believe the government? Look what's happening to energy and healthcare and everything else.
Yep.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at the Radio Liberty, and our guest this afternoon, Colonel Barry Turner, and of course he's talking about what's going on in Great Britain, and of course the stark parallels between what's going on there and what's going on here in the United States. He's been talking about the money power and recognizing that the money power, and what this money power is. It's sort of hard to put your finger on. It's like mercury. But I will tell you, it goes right back to those meetings that were held in the early part of the 20th century, described by H.G. Wells in his book, An Experiment in Autobiography. Great book, important book. And there you find out, here are these international financiers, the leaders of the banking industry in Great Britain, with ties throughout the banking industry of the world, working with the socialists, plotting on how they're going to take over a Great Britain and change that transform the world. And they've certainly done it here in the last century.
Well, it has a lot to do, ultimately, I think, with human greed. I mean, we're on a roller coaster. We're destroying the environment, which means we're slowly destroying the planet and its natural resources. Latest one I saw was the mowing down of the Indonesian rainforest to provide timber for, you know, the modern requirements and modern domestic requirements and so on and so forth. And, you know, this just goes on. And somebody is making money at each stage. And it becomes this question of power, because I was thinking about a small business I once knew 60 years ago. A family was doing very well with two baker's shops and a baking business. Now, okay, in the local community, that was sufficient for them. You can have a chain of shops or businesses of some one sort or another in a town, in a district, or nationally. But, of course, we've gone far beyond that. And I suppose since the 1930s, business has become very much internationalized, as we all know. And that power has gone from national governments. So is the integrity of trying to control it. Because now, in our case, I have no doubt, and I think it's been written many times, the present government has simply thrown in its lot with the multinational corporations. This government, the early Blair government, attempted to throw in its lot completely with the Monsanto Corporation on genetically modified organisms in food and agriculture. Yeah. And it was only public resistance that put the brakes on that. We had the multilateral agreement on investment, the MAI. I think France scuppered that. Our own government backed it. And this would have given multinational corporations the power over sovereign government on their policies. They could overrule governments on employment, on manufacturing, all sorts of things. In other words, power had left national boundaries. But if you come back, I think, to money, I very much believe in the old social credit cry, I think this is where it lies, that you wouldn't run a train half empty for lack of tickets. Now, if you roll back to essential public services, health care, law and order, the police in other words, education, we have all the natural resources required in terms of human material.
Hold that thought right there, please. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, Colonel Turner is just talking about how he feels that, of course, what's really behind this is the desire for money, the desire for power, and really the way that many of the major corporations are really controlling government. Well, of course, what you're really talking about is this corporate socialist state of fascism. That's what fascism is all about. And, of course, in Hitler's Germany, it was called Nazism. In Russia, it was called communism, but it's all basically the same thing. The only question is who's got to be in charge, but it's the total loss of freedom on the part of the individual. And Colonel Turner was just saying that he believes that the social credit may be the approach. Now, this is something that is really an idea that has been expressed in Great Britain for a long period of time. Do you want to develop that idea for our American listeners? Because most of them don't understand what social credit is.
Well, I'm no expert on social credit. I was quoting from, you know, one of their principles, that the social credit, of course, is a sort of an inversion of the taxation system. It was put into operation in Canada, I think Alberta, before the war. It lasted a few years, but not beyond that. There are a lot of advocates of social credit, particularly in Australia, where we have people that we work with. But the essential point here, I think, is a rather simpler one based on the existing system as it is, rather than radical change. This is that a government, and I'm talking about the United Kingdom, has the right to create its own money to fund public needs. Now, after the war, a very good book by a man called Michael Robotham called The Grip of Death, study of modern money, debt slavery, and destructive economics, pointed out that after the war, 50% of the money created was that created by the government to meet public needs, and 50% was created by the private banking system to meet private business needs. Now, that had dropped to about 20% in the 1960s. And according to Michael Robartson, the amount of money created by the government is currently between 3 and 4%. And that's a massive drop. And, of course, the way money is represented, which was once in hard cash, in notes and coin, became part of the banking system as we moved on to a banking system, credit card system. Now, that doesn't mean to say the government cannot find a way around that. The point is, it hasn't. Governments are now in the hands of the banks. And if one challenges, say, a member of parliament, as I've done, on this question, that the government has a right to create its own money instead of borrowing the balance from the banks at interest, which we pay as taxation, they don't want to know. Although, in parliament, in our case, we do have an early day motion tabled, which says that the government should do just this. In other words, it has political credibility now. And the early day motion, which changed its number with each session of parliament, has been going, I think, for about five sessions of parliament. It's supported by something in the order of 20 to 30 members of parliament out of 650. And the principle is that if they can get, for any early day motion, which any MP can table, if they get support of 100 names, I think I'm right in saying, then it has to be debated in Parliament. But it has got a foot in the door.
But of course, this is the last thing the International Banking Cartel wants, is a real open discussion. In fact, they don't want the people of either Great Britain or Europe or the United States to realize that banks create money out of nothing. They create money out of nothing, and then they have the audacity to charge us interest on it and charge the government interest on it. And of course, what you're doing is having a special class of people who can get tribute from the great masses to the banking system. And the average individual has no idea that banks create money out of absolutely nothing.
Yes. We do have a certain resistance to this. The Forum for Stable Currencies, which advocates economic democracy through freedom from debt, does meet in the House of Lords, in the committee room in the House of Lords monthly. I've been to two or three of their meetings, but I don't go to London very often. And there are members of the House of Lords and one or two members of Parliament, such as Austin Mitchell, named here, who are part of this movement. So, the philosophy has a foot well inside the door of our Parliament here in Westminster.
But of course,
Sorry.
I was just going to say, but if we do not, you know, get the people to understand what this is all about, this idea of wage slavery, if they don't understand how this whole monetary system works, why, it may one day soon be far too late.
Well, yes.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Colonel Barry Turner. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295 if you'd like to call in. And we're talking about, of course, the monetary impact on and the monetary implications of so much of what's going on. And certainly here in the United States, why we've had a number of our congressmen, Congressman Lewis McFadden, head of the House Banking Committee for many years, they tried repeatedly to kill him. He kept trying to tell the American people what was happening. I mean, how during the middle of the Depression, when there was no money for American corporations, the Federal Reserve System was sending money to Adolf Hitler and to the communists in Russia. Then we had Wright Patman, and of course he tried to tell the American people what was going on. They targeted him for destruction, and certainly then we had Henry Gonzalez, who was an old-line Democrat. He headed the House Banking Commission. He tried to tell the American people, but the average individual has no idea how the banking system dominates our society and creates money out of nothing and then buys bonds, and we've got, and with the money they've created out of nothing, and we've got to pay them tribute, we've got to pay them interest, and I'm sure similar things happen in Great Britain, don't they, Colonel?
Well, it's long haul. I can briefly toss the ball back into your court, because a couple of years ago at the Bromsgrove Group for Monetary and Economic Reform Conference, I listened to Stephen Zarlenga, the American Monetary Institute. So there is similar thinking in the United States, and I know one or two colleagues of mine have been over and addressed them. I see there is a monetary reform conference in Chicago in September this year, 21st to 24th. So it does have, you know, it's taking root, but how far one can motivate the cold porridge of the mass of the people whose interest and concern you need to recruit is another matter. I mean, an old commander of mine used to talk about cold porridge. When you stop pushing it, it stops moving. And this is one of the problems we've got. We had, in this town here, we had a very well-attended protest meeting of some 300 people demanding the reinstatement of what we call our district hospital, the local hospital for routine sort of medical treatment and emergency, accident and emergency, maternity, that sort of thing. Now, we lost our hospital 15 years ago as a part of a health service economy.
Hold that thought right there, if you would, please, and we'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Colonel Turner is talking about how in Great Britain they had lost their regional hospital. In other words, the government had just shut it down, saying there just wasn't enough money. And, of course, this puts the people into a very difficult situation because in Great Britain, health care is socialized, and, of course, you take away the hospital, and you have to, travel quite a distance to get medical care in emergency?
Well, yeah, you see, the people of this town, which is about 16,000 strong, with a catchment area in the, you know, the wider borough of about 38,000, have to travel 17 miles to the next large town, to a large hospital. And you can travel in the middle of the night and wait for hours. The only accident and emergency treatment otherwise is open only during working hours as a sub-department of our local specialist orthopedic hospital, which happens to be in the same town. Now, I went, before this protest meeting, I went to see a leading councillor, in other words, an elected borough representative who was involved in this. And I attempted to outline the way the government could create money, if it so wished, if the banks allowed it to, shall we say. And I was waved airily away with words something like, you know, oh, I know all about the money system. And when that person told me what they understood about the money system, it was quite clear they knew damn all about it. They hadn't a clue. It was I was referred to a talk this person had attended many years ago by somebody in the most broad brush conventional terms. So when you have this problem of local elected representatives who not only don't know but don't want to know, they don't know how to go about tackling the system at the very outset. Neither do they know on what grounds to tackle their Member of Parliament to force the issue further. And this is just one example of the sort of problem we have. But when you talk about healthcare, it's rather interesting. We're talking about power again, power, international power, for example, and the power of the establishment. Really, we have the mass of the people, and you're talking about all levels of society, and a very involved ruling elite who almost live on a different plane. It's almost like, in the case of the present government, it's rather like the Soviet nomenklatura. There's little difference between them, but a huge ruling elite behind them. Your ruling elite, I suspect, are integrated in the government, with, you know, the Cheney-Halliburton links, referred to as the richest government in American history, I think, when Bush set up his first cabinet. Ours are more in the position of working for their masters, the power brokers behind them. And if you take education, for example, after the war we had this change in education, with education for all, and it became comprehensive education. And what effectively they did was destroy the existing system in the local towns and boroughs and cities, the regional system, but they did not apply it to the major public schools. Eton is a well-known one, I think, by everybody. They did not force them to follow the same system. So you finished up still with a system for those who could afford it. And health has gone the same way. If you have enough money, you can buy instant treatment, jump the queue, in other words, by using the private system. Whereas you can wait weeks, perhaps months, for the same treatment if you use the normal health service.
Well, I will never forget when I was teaching at the university. I was a professor at the University of the Orange Free State, and we traveled to the orthopedic group to Edinburgh, and I talked then to the a professor of orthopedics in Edinburgh, and he commented that how unavailable elective surgery was. If you needed an elective surgical procedure, they put you on a list, and they never got to you. If you had an emergency, of course, you could get it taken care of, but elective procedures, he said, we put you on the list, we never get to you unless you are a commissar. And that was his word. If you're a commissar, we have to take you in immediately, meaning you're somebody who works for the government. What sort of egalitarian society is that? That's what a truly a communist government's all about. And it was right there in Edinburgh, and this was, what, in the mid-1970s when I was there, and I expect it's even worse today.
Well, yes, it's a very simplistic approach, the one I've given you, because there are many issues within the health service, very many, and the organizational problems, which are enormous. I think one of our difficulties is we haven't got any competent ministers at the moment, political appointees, in a position to get it right. It's a huge employer, of course. I think it's the biggest employer in Europe, the health service in this country. But you do have what never has been and is not intended to be a genuine facility for all in education or in health. I don't think it was ever intended. I don't think it was ever possible. And we keep being given these illusions of an egalitarian or increasingly egalitarian society when there's no such thing. And one has to face the fact that in the animal kingdom, it's a pyramid from top to bottom, but it doesn't alter the fact that privileges within that should not be allowed to exist. So the whole thing has been an illusion.
Absolutely. And of course, the trouble is that you've had your socialized medical system. You have good doctors, but it takes so long to get the treatment unless it's an emergency situation. Because socialized medicine really doesn't work well. It's never going to work well. And in Great Britain, you were more or less forced to actually establish an escape valve. In other words, to create a situation where if you had enough money, you could buy private health care. In Canada, you can't even buy private health care. And the only reason that system works is because the Canadians can come to the United States. Socialism is a sincere, benevolent, idealistic theory, but it doesn't work without force. And somebody's going to be in charge. Somebody's going to be the master, and somebody's going to be the slave.
Yes, this is the way things are tending to work at the moment. Another complication is that we have what is called a private finance initiative in the health service and in education. In other words, the government shares the operation and maintenance of hospitals and schools in certain cases with private companies. Now, the problem you have then, of course, is the debt problem, chasing the debt all the time, which is fundamental to the monetary system as it is, and a profit has to be made. Therefore, one assumes that an efficient private organization will achieve both ends, running a proper service, say a hospital or a number of schools, and making a profit for itself. And the debt spiral is taken into account. Well, of course, what happens, and we know this almost every time, nobody ever manages to catch the debt spiral in the end, like General Motors or Ford, in the same sort of trouble. So we have hospitals threatening, there must be about 20 of them announced recently across the country, threatening huge job losses, closure of wards, closure of facilities, because they're broke. Now, again, it's this question of how money is brought into existence and how it is controlled. But if you challenge the Treasury, as I did through my Member of Parliament, one is told that for the government to create money is inflationary. They don't give you the parallel to that, of course. They don't admit the parallel that the private creation of money is off the scale globally, let alone nationally, and we're in this huge debt trap. And how we get out of it, I'm damned if I know. I mean, if you refer to David Corton's book, When Corporations Rule the World, there you have it. I mean, the statistics show that the whole thing is off the scale.
Well, I think that's what's really planned, is with a corporate world government. In fact, this is the story that was told by Edward Bellamy back in 1882 in his book Looking Backwards. And Bellamy's book foretold a time when the corporations would rule the world. And of course, this more modern book that you're speaking of, this is the direction we're headed. But then who controls the corporations is the question.
Well, a very good question. I've got another book here by Dr. Norina Hertz, who I think was with Cambridge University at the time, called The Silent Takeover. The subtitle is Global Capitalism and the Death of Democracy.
But you see,
I mean, that tells you volumes.
Well, of course, we have the two problems. We have, on one hand, we have the socialists. They want total power. On the other hand, we have the corporations, and they want total power. And then what happens to the individual? If the socialists take over, we lose our freedom. If the corporations take over, we lose our freedom. What people do not understand, and this is, of course, one of the things we try to educate people on, and is so important that we had a great investigation of the great tax-exempt foundations back in 1953 and 54, and a book was written about that that's been suppressed for 50 years. We've kept it in print for many years, pointing out that the corporations and the socialists are working together. They both want power. And so where then will the average individual get his freedom when you have these two powerful forces aligned together against us common folks?
Well, the way we're discussing this is a very simplified version of a very complex scenario. But if one meets, as I did, somebody in the street whose pension scheme to which they've been contributing through their career has collapsed to the extent they will receive only 10% of the pension they planned for on retirement, then one is again witnessing something which has been a major crisis in this country for a long time, and the government has simply withdrawn from any responsibility for this, although its legislation on pension funds is at the root of it to a degree. And the same with state pensions. The money, and of course the longer life expectancy, mean that unless the government creates money, prints the train tickets to stop the train running half empty, then the crisis will only get worse. And what they're doing now is fiddling the books, cooking the books, and all it's doing is putting off the evil day by extending retirement ages. Now, British Airways have just announced that the retirement age for pilots and cabin crews has been extended from 55 to 60. Now, again, this is stalling the problem with pension funds.
But, of course, if you're a politician, what you really want is to, you know, stall it off until you get out of office, you know, hoping that the next people are going to get the blame for the catastrophe that lies ahead. We're having the same problems here, as certainly as Delta Airlines and Northwest Airlines and United Airlines are just going to do away with their pension funds. General Motors and certainly Ford are really teetering on the edge of bankruptcy. Delphi, Datum, so many of our large corporations, even IBM has cut off any new pension funds for their salaried workers. Yes, and you're having the same problems in Great Britain as we have here in the United States, making promises to people that could never be fulfilled, and they've always known it. That's the incredible part of this.
It's hardly surprising that people have a healthy contempt for politics and politicians. And I think this applies on both sides of the Atlantic. Classically, of course, in the current context, over the situation in the Middle East. But I'm sort of digressing from the money angle. I use a restaurant in Wales. My wife and I quite often go over there. And the proprietor was telling us that a hygiene inspector, an elderly man, arrived to do a hygiene inspection on the kitchens. And in conversation, it turned out that he had to return to work because his pension scheme had collapsed. And he came to the retirement age with no pension. Again, it's just another example of what is happening. And, of course, what he, in effect, did was become a bureaucrat. Because he had to work again. So here he was, employed to go around inspecting kitchens. And had to justify his job, of course, and make the appropriate observations.
And make everybody's life miserable, because that's what bureaucrats do. In fact, if you go back and read the writings of Cicero, he talked about how the arrogance of officialdom had to be tempered. That was written 26 years before Christ was born.
Well, it hasn't changed much, has it?
No.
Just increased in scale.
Right. Well, I think that, really, you talk about the current economic situation. The truth of the matter is, there is no solution. I'm putting together a talk on this called The Financial Tsunami. I'm going to be giving it to Southern California in about 2 weeks, and I'll be giving it at the Conspiracy Conference here in the end of May. And analyzing what's going on and talking to people who are very knowledgeable, there is no solution. These people are going to be impoverished. So many are expecting pensions from the government here in Social Security, and I don't know what you call your pensions, but so many of the people who think they're going to get pensions from state government, from the federal government, from the corporations, they're in for a big surprise. The whole system is going to collapse. It has to collapse, and they're doing everything they can, that is the elite, to be sure it collapses. It's only a matter not of if, but when. So I think we really have to feel very sorry for these people, but perhaps if they hadn't put so much faith in government and in politicians, they wouldn't be in the trouble they are today.
We have to educate ourselves, get people, other people to educate themselves, and take genuine power back from the politicians so that they genuinely and properly work for those who elect them. Until we get this right, I don't think anything is going to change. But of course, it has become internationalized to such an extent that it's a huge problem to tackle, and one can only discuss it, you know, in very simplistic terms. But this is the nub of the thing, isn't it?
And of course, the same thing is happening in Europe, where they're having demonstrations over there as they try to increase the work week, or they got to cut back on the pensions, and the people say you can't do it, and the politicians are saying, fellas, there isn't any money. And this is a real problem. Well, Colonel, it's really a pleasure to have you, and I appreciate so much for being with us. Do you have a website or anything you'd like to put out?
No, I don't. I don't have a personal website. And I really only speak as an individual, only operate as an individual, apparently.
All right, fine.
Well, I'm delighted to be invited and to talk about these things.
Well, we appreciate that. And incidentally, you're going to be with us another 3 minutes before we let you go. But I do hope that you'll ask our mutual friend, Robert Theobald, to give me a call. I have something I want to talk to him about.
Yes, I will indeed.
Thanks so much. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Colonel Barry Turner. We're really talking about the economic problems that face his country, but the problems are exactly the same here in the United States. In fact, even some of the same forces that are at work in both of our countries. And, of course, it gets into the fact that we have a banking industry that is controlled by people we have no control over. And they, of course, have taken control of our currency, and those who control the currency control the destiny of a nation. So, Colonel, we've got about 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes for you to wrap up your thoughts.
Well, let me toss in a random brick, if I may. This availability and creation of money. Channel 4 television in this country, a couple of days ago, had an hour-long program, Dispatches, Iraq's Missing Billions. Now, notes were transported from America, from the United States to Iraq, in huge volumes. Billions. And so there was a capacity there to print this money into the system, and it vanished.
$8.8 billion just vanished. Nobody knows where it is. Oh shucks, well, we're just so disorganized. Can anybody really believe that?
Well, I've got a figure, $20 billion here, and a quote.
$20 billion. I guess I'm very conservative.
Well, a quote: Iraq was awash with cash. We played football with some of the bricks of $100 bills. That's a quote here. And it vanished. And they're just as badly off now as they were before. So it's a very interesting point that, you know, money can be made available if it's required. But whose account it came from is anybody's guess. I should imagine it was created out of nothing in the usual way.
It really was, and of course the thing is that interest will have to be paid on that, and our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren will be paying interest on this if, of course, there's any stability at all to our economic system. But debt eventually destroys an economic system, and this is the trouble. I suspect both Great Britain and the United States are so overburdened with debt that there will be no solution until it is contracted, and, well, an awful lot of people, I think, are going to be very badly hurt in the times that lie ahead.
Well, I think with China and India coming on stream fast, we should start to worry seriously.
Well, I think that we're moving into uncharted waters, as Alan Greenspan, the chairman of our Federal Reserve System, said recently, and I think we're going to have to pay eventually a very, very heavy price for the fact that we've lived so well for so long, and really many times at the expense of others. Colonel, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us. It's always a pleasure. We'll look forward to having you back on again with us.
Thank you, Hagen. Thank you for having me.
And please ask Robert to give me a call.
Yeah, I will do.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and if you'd be interested in hearing my talk on the coming financial crisis, it's available on DVD, and, of course, our new talk, which will be bring in a lot more information, will be available here in another month or so, but the coming financial crisis is really the foundation of the talk we're giving. We have a pamphlet. It's called The History of Money. You need to get that. The pamphlet's only $3.95. And then, of course, we have the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, Gold for Investment by Professor Sutton, and Gold for Survival by Professor Sutton, and then the classic book on money, Fiat Money Inflation in France, written over 150 years ago, but it's a book you need to read to understand what's going on today. So that, of course, is my talk, The Coming Financial Crisis, the pamphlet, The History of Money, the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, the book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy by Professor Sutton, rather inexpensive, but very, very good, Gold for Survival by Professor Sutton, Gold for Investment And then, of course, fiat money inflation in France. You need to understand the monetary system if you have any hope of surviving what lies ahead. And then, of course, we hope that many of you out there will listen to our regular programs. We put together a new four-tape set. It's called Financial Armageddon. It's my interviews with Bob Chapman and Cal Grunville and Ron Brown and Melody Cedarstrom. And we'll be updating these tapes on a regular basis. But they're all recent interviews, bring you up to date with what's really going on today. If you have not yet ordered your case of our books, Brotherhood of Darkness, we hope that you will. That's Brotherhood of Darkness, and you get 64 books for $149.95, and, of course, you can turn around and sell them for $12.95 each. You can do whatever you want to, but we need to get, we hope within the next week to 10 days, where we'll have the full commitment, the full pledges in, and then we can go ahead and order the books to be printed, because you're not going to get the books till they're printed, and they're not going to be printed till we have enough orders, and we're well over half there now. So if you'd like to, we get a full case of my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, which is an excellent weapon, a means of beginning to educate people about the spiritual forces that are energizing everything going on today. Our number again is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. So we do look forward to hearing from you, and hope that you will take the time to get our material and get it out. If you have not yet seen my talk on The World Revolution, it's a video we did, and we think it's an excellent one. My talk on planned population reduction, certainly the very excellent and award-winning video. It's available on DVD by Chris Pinto and David Bain. The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings. It goes into the secret societies. They were there in 1650. They're still here today. They have the Rosicrucian Temple right over in San Jose. You can go over there and you can look at it. The Rosicrucians have been around going back into the 1400s. Their goal, a new world order, a new world religion. And, of course, with that, a new world financial system, because really it's money that makes the world go round, unfortunately. And very, very evil people are in control of the world monetary system and are creating money out of nothing and enslaving governments and enslaving people. So you'll want to get certainly my pamphlet on the history of money, give you tremendous insight into this, and then give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. You can listen to our programs there 5 hours a day on the Internet, and some places in the country on radio, and 4 hours on shortwave, and 9 hours on Telstar 5 satellite. You won't get much done, but you'll get an awful lot of education. And please tell others about our program. We are available. We're there. We're trying to educate people about the fact we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Till tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.